From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, television critic Rick Cushman tells you what's new on TV and in the TV business. Also, a Sacramento man recently honored by Britain's Queen Elizabeth. He's a UK citizen who won 2 gold medals in cycling in last fall's Paralympic Games. First, should Sacramento's mayor be a citywide council member or a CEO? For now, the city's mayor is the former, in other words, a member of the city council with a big soapbox and no executive powers. The city's new mayor, Kevin Johnson, has started a campaign to change that. He wants Sacramento's charter amended so that the mayor becomes the city government's CEO. Voters could decide whether or not the city will have a so-called strong mayor in an election this year. Today we'll hear arguments for and against a strong mayor. Mayor Johnson will be on our show, but he is on his way here. So we're going to start with an interview, a brief interview I recorded just about 15 minutes ago with Mayor Alan Autry. He is the mayor of Fresno, but this is actually his last day in office. He couldn't join us at this time because he's meeting with the person who's going to be the next mayor of Fresno. And I started by asking Alan Autry why, a couple of weeks ago, he made the trip up to Sacramento to publicly support Mayor Kevin Johnson's proposal to give Sacramento's mayor executive power.
Well, every city in California, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. We're all in this thing together. All California is a collection of cities and counties, and we're so interdependent on each other to be able to be a healthy city and how that affects other cities. It's just the right thing to do, because here in Fresno, we went from the type of system that is currently in place in Sacramento to the strong mayor format, and it's helped us move further faster than any time in our history, Jeff, and I think he'll do the same thing for Sacramento under Mayor Johnson's leadership.
Could you give us an example of something that you were able to do as mayor that you don't think you would have been able to do or achieve if you had not been a quote-unquote strong mayor?
Well, what the mayor, strong mayor format's what we call it here, is kind of a misnomer, because still, even with the very significant and broad authority and power that it gives the mayor, it's still the mayor's office is dependent upon the council, and the council on the mayor, and both of those bodies are dependent on the people to get anything done. But what it does is instantly create accountability for the people of the city to have that individual office carry enough power to hold accountable in a big way. And as we know, you have to have that in a business. You have to have that certainly in government in order to get things done and get the most bang for the taxpayer buck. I'm sorry, I'm driving along here and it's raining here and I'm going to run over somebody. But
well, I appreciate you taking time to join us.
And also, what it also does, Jeff, is allow for a true debate and to occur, and also have a real legitimate checks and balances. I know it sounds good when you say, well, everybody's accountable, everything's equal, but then you have, if everybody's accountable to the same degree, then nobody's accountable.
What about your relations with the city council?
You know, I think it's made it better. There comes a time when a city becomes a certain size, or any organization becomes a certain size, that you need to develop a point of authority. I hate to say power, but it is. It's a very powerful position of which you can hold accountable. And if you develop a working relationship and have it in your set of values to have a working relationship with the council, it happens. It's happened here in Fresno. And again, the results have been we've probably the healthiest city in California in terms of dealing with the economic crisis. We have an $18 million reserve, haven't had to lay off anybody, increase public safety, invest in our poorest neighborhoods. And we wouldn't really, be able to do any of that if we didn't have the system in place. Now, if you are not committed to collaboration, if you just try to use that power in an authoritative way and not collaborate, it's not going to work, but you know you're not going to last long in office anyway. You'll be four and out.
And finally, Mayor Autry, are there any downsides that you can think of to having a mayor of a city with executive authority as opposed to a mayor who's basically a citywide council member?
You know, in comparison, Jeff, to the two systems, there's no downside. Now, somebody once said the American form of democracy is the worst system ever devised by man, except all the rest. It certainly has its weaknesses, but in straight comparison, the city council or city manager-led structure and the mayor format, there is no downside. The mayor is responsible for developing a budget, presenting it to the council. They do their due diligence and deliberation and negotiate with the mayor on behalf of the people. And that simple checks and balances of in itself is better than the system that you have in place now.
Mayor Alan Autry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. God bless.
That's Mayor Alan Autry on his last day as mayor of Fresno. We recorded that interview about 15 minutes ago. We're going to continue our discussion of whether or not Sacramento should have a so-called strong mayor. We have three guests in our studio, including a former mayor of Sacramento and a political science professor at UC Davis. But we'll start with the person who has brought this issue to the fore right now in Sacramento, Mayor Kevin Johnson. Mayor, welcome back to Insight as mayor.
Thanks, Jeff.
Why do you think the mayor of Sacramento needs more direct authority?
I think people clearly want to see Sacramento go to the next level as a city. And I think it's really about accountability and responsiveness. I think we're in a very peculiar predicament right now with our budget deficit that we're still trying to work our way through. Unemployment rate is extremely high. Obviously, the downturn in the economy around our country, our schools are not performing at the level that we need them to be. And I think Sacramento clearly is ready to be one of the 60 to 70% of larger cities that have an executive mayor structure. And it really boils down to accountability and a much more responsive form of government.
Why would there be more accountability in the system if the mayor, you or whoever the mayor is, has executive authority over the city?
Yeah, again, a fair question. And I love the fact that we're debating and talking about this because I think this certainly warrants this. Right now, let me just preface by saying I'm a huge fan of the city manager, Ray Carriage. I think he's done a great job in moving our city forward. But right now, Ray Carriage is the executive of the city. He's the chief executive officer of the city, and he's not an elected member. And as a result, you have council members and a mayor who are actually elected but aren't accountable for the day-to-day operations of the city. And I think that's the very fundamental difference right there. So if a mayor is the chief executive of the city, then a voter's vote is able to hold that mayor accountable for the results that are going well. And if the results aren't going well, then you basically can give a term limit and have somebody else run for mayor of that city.
If this issue does go to the voters and the voters say, no, we like the way things are, how would that affect your perception of your job as mayor?
Again, good question. I think if people and voters liked the way things, the way they were, I wouldn't get a vote. I wouldn't have been mayor of the city right now. I think that they would have voted for the status quo and have things continue to go down the direction that they're going. I think the voters clearly said that we want change and we want a different leadership and we want a different vision in our city. And I think that's why I got elected. And I think that's very important to note. Again, when you look at our unemployment being the highest it's been in a decade and, obviously our challenges in our budget, those are things that we do not want to continue going down the road. So I think that's very clear in terms of what voters, said they wanted and would like to see more of. I will say this, though. When I was running, I said that this is a debate that our city should have, and I'm glad we're having it. But I also said that I believe I can be effective in the current structure, which is a weak mayor structure, and still get results. It's going to be a lot more difficult. It's a lot more time-consuming. It's a lot more bureaucratic, and it doesn't make your government as nimble, and it's much more difficult to be accountable to those results as it would be if the mayor structure changes.
Did you consider waiting to see what the reality is like as a mayor with the mayor's current powers?
No. Again, while I was campaigning for 8 or 9 months, I said that this is a debate that the city should have. And right now, rather than wait a long time on it, let's start debating it right now and see if the merit of it warrants this being approved. And I feel very confident in the people that I've talked to and being out in the community. People are excited about that. They want to be able to have their mayor be accountable for results, and they want their government to be much more responsive.
Mayor Kevin Johnson, also in our studio, Ann Rudin, who was mayor of Sacramento from 1983 to 1992. Ann, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
When you were mayor, did you ever wish you had more direct authority over the city government?
No, no. As a matter of fact, this issue has come up several times, and it always was cast aside as not something that Sacramento wanted or needed. I never felt that I was not influential over what went on, or that I did not have power. we had influence over the city government, over the city manager. I and the city council worked very closely with the city manager. We could influence policy. I was involved in a lot of the issues that came before the city council, and I never felt that I was constrained by anything in the city charter or lack of something in the city charter. I don't like the terminology strong mayor, weak mayor, because I think that it's very misleading. The mayor's power and influence is inherent in the position that the mayor holds. The mayor holds the highest political office in the city, and as such, it's respected, and the mayor is given a lot of responsibility, and the mayor is held responsible. At 11:30 at night, when the rivers are overflowing their banks, who do they call? They call me to get the people out there to put up the sandbags or whatever has to be done. I call the city manager and I say, get them out there. You know, people are worried about their property. So I had the ability to make things happen, to direct how things went without having to have a power over appointment. That, I think, is a very dangerous thing to have.
Why?
Why? Because you are mixing politics with administration, and I think politics should be separate from administration. Administration should not be influenced by political considerations. And if the mayor has the power to appoint top staff, department heads, and so forth, the pressures, the political pressures, are going to be tremendous.
But aren't those the same powers that the president and the governor has?
Well, this is not the state of California. I mean, this is...
Oh, I understand. Yes. But it's not unprecedented for an elected official in a government body to have that kind of power.
Right. And I really can't... I will have to leave it to the political scientist to explain the difference on that. Maybe it doesn't always work for the governor either. I mean, the governor can appoint people who have political agendas or who are carrying somebody else's political agenda.
Well, before we go to that political scientist, I want to go back to Mayor Johnson because I know you have to leave us in a few minutes. Could you respond to what Ann Rudin was saying there?
Yeah, I think that the former mayor just has a different vision of Sacramento. We're no longer that city that we were when she was governing. I think that people clearly want a different vision for our community. And when you're talking about the powers, I mean, they're no different than the legislative side and the executive side. There's a balance of power. The check and balances don't go anywhere. And again, over 60-some-odd% of the top 50 cities have this governance structured that I'm talking about. So it's not unprecedented by any means.
When you were running for mayor, there were former employees at St. Hope, the nonprofit organization that you founded, runs charter schools and other organizations. These are former employees who said that you are a micromanager and such like. At the same time, you're asking for CEO powers over the city of Sacramento. How would you respond to people who are concerned about what they heard in the campaign about your executive abilities?
Again, I got elected by a large margin because I think people in the community have embraced the vision that I've laid out. And that vision is that we want Sacramento to be a world-class destination city. And I think we have the potential to do that. We've had tons of missed opportunities. And I will say this very clearly. Had a mayor been in a different structure, a structure that I'm referring to with more accountability, I think that we could have moved Greyhound. I think that we wouldn't have the hole in the ground that we currently have. But when you get so caught up in bureaucracy, people don't want to get caught up in bureaucracy anymore. Those days are done. They want action, they want results, and they want accountability. And I think this is what this shift will allow our city. And as a result, when you have a nimble government that can get things done much more quicker, our community is going to benefit. So yes, there were people in the past who worked for St. Hope, and anytime somebody gets let go, they're disgruntled and are going to say things that aren't as positive. And that's fine. You know, people are entitled to that opinion. But, you know, my strength of leadership, I would believe, is I would sit down. Let me give one simple example. I would sit down with the chief of police and I would say, you know, our priorities in this city and what I've heard in the community are we want to reduce crime, we want to improve our response time, and we want to win the war on gangs. So those are three priorities. Now, that chief would need to tell me what resources he needs from me to make it happen, but I'm not going to micromanage. We're going to set some goals and measure those very clearly. And the way we're set up now, that doesn't happen. There's a middle person. There's an in-between, and I don't have any ability to hold the chief directly accountable. And I was out taking a tour at our emergency operations center the other day. Lord forbid that we have a flood breakout in our city like in New Orleans. I don't have any real say over how that happens. I just have to respond to the city manager and other people, and then I go out to the media and say, well, here's how we got in a predicament, and I would like to be held accountable for the actions of this community. I think that's very clear.
And finally, Mayor Johnson, can the city afford a special election on this?
I think, again, the number that people are throwing around, I'm not sure is an accurate number, but my first responsibility is to make sure that we're fiscally sound and our fiscal health is in good shape. So I would do nothing that would be a detriment to our financial situation. I've made that a top priority for us to bring in an independent firm to do an audit of our both finances and operations. And it's still a little premature because there's a lot of variables. You know, if there's a special election in June or if there's a special election in November, what will that ultimate cost be to our community? But I would never recommend that we do anything that would set us back financially. But on the flip side, we would have to do a financial analysis and to see that if this form of government changes, are there cost savings in short term and long term that will impact the city? And I think that's the entirety of the debate.
It would have been nice to have that discussion before this hit the streets.
Do you want to respond to that, Mayor?
No need.
Okay. Well, I know you have to leave us. Mayor Kevin Johnson, thank you so much.
Jeff, please invite me back for this topic. I'd love to come back.
Thank you. Well, let's continue now with our political scientist, Robert Huckfeldt, who's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UC Davis. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Many of California's biggest cities have the so-called strong mayor system of government. Is it the norm nationwide among larger cities?
It's certainly the norm among larger cities, but in fact, the strong mayor system, in quotes, inside large California cities often isn't as strong as some of the mayor's offices are in other cities across the country. So a city like Los Angeles, for example, has a mayor that's more circumscribed in terms of what his powers or her powers would actually be than they would be if that same person was in a different city, a different large city in the United States.
Is there a trend towards giving mayors executive powers?
There's been a steady movement from council manager forms, which I think the previous comment was right, that that's a misnomer to call those weak mayor systems. Exactly. They're a council and a manager with a titular mayor who has some responsibilities but is primarily a member of the city council.
And the council hires and fires the city manager.
Exactly.
But the city manager hires and fires the key staff in the city.
Exactly. That form of government, which is what we have now, across the country, there have been fewer of those over time as more and more cities have been moved toward the mayor-council form or the strong mayor form of government.
What are the main arguments against a strong mayor system?
Well, I think to really understand the arguments best, you need to go back to when they were originated, and they came into play during the progressive era that gave California most of its institutions in the early 20th century. At that point, there was an effort to, quote unquote, clean up city government across the country, and one of the ways that was done, it was believed, was to get politics out of administration, just as was mentioned earlier, to try to separate policy and politics from administration and take administration and give it over to bureaucrats and professional managers who would in fact run the government as a management enterprise. So it really is much like the model of a modern corporation where you have a board of trustees or a board of governors for the corporation. They in turn hire the executive branch that does their business for them. And there are a lot of institutions besides cities like that in California. There's also counties typically are run that way. In California.
Bob Huckfeldt is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UC Davis. Ann Rudin, Kevin Johnson, when he was running for mayor, did talk a lot about this issue. He didn't say he was going, at least not on the record that I heard, he didn't say that he was going to bring it to the fore as quickly as he has. Is that a problem for you?
I think it's problematic, but before I tell you why, the last time we talked and Mayor Eisenberg and I were saying what we would advise the new mayor to do. I said I would advise him to expect the unexpected. Well, those words turned back on me because I didn't expect the unexpected. I did not expect this to be brought forward so soon, so early in his term. He had hardly been in very long to find out what the situation was and how the office functioned before he decided that he wanted to change it. So I've gotten away from your question.
That's okay.
Because what was the last part of the question?
Well, just your reaction to the pace at which Mayor Johnson has brought this issue to the fore.
I think whenever you want to make change, you have to first see what it is you have to change. What is it you want to change? Is there a problem with city government as it exists now? If there is a problem, how can it be fixed? But you do it. And is this the best way to do it? Is this the best way to fix the problem? You do it out in the open. You reach your conclusions through discussions with the city council, with the public in public forums. And that did not happen here. Nobody knew it was coming. And I think that's what disturbed a lot of people, the fact that a proposal was set forth without knowing what the real problem is that was intended to be solved.
Setting aside the pace at which this has happened, what's your general opinion about giving the mayor of Sacramento executive power?
First of all, not every mayor has executive ability. A mayor's race is a popularity contest. It's like a horse race. People can become mayor on the basis of popularity and have in the past. But most of them have had business experience or some kind of executive experience, yet they never wanted to have a strong, so-called strong mayor power. I think that whoever is the administrator, the city manager, ought to have some knowledge of public policy formation, how you run a business, how you run the city, which is a form of business, how you deal with staff, how you deal with the public. There are a lot of things there that a professional manager learns how to do, maybe through coming up through the ranks, that a mayor does not necessarily have.
And Robert Huckfeldt, finally, if the mayor of Sacramento does acquire executive powers, what kind of changes could we expect to see in the way Sacramento is run? Mayor Johnson says the whole point of this is to add accountability to the system. Do you think the people of Sacramento would see more accountability in the city government system if the mayor was given executive power?
Well, I think the people of the city of Sacramento could certainly call him into account and call any strong mayor into account in a way that they wouldn't be able to legitimately if, in fact, he didn't have those sorts of powers. Right now, mayors promise a great deal, but their ability to pull that off is somewhat limited. So I think that would be a major change. The other major change is I think it's a mistake to think that strong mayor means weak council. In fact, what will happen as a consequence of mayors and councils and strong mayors and councils is that the council will define a new role. It will be primarily a legislative body. They'll have a voice in opposition on many issues to the mayor, and it'll be just simply a transformed way to do business.
And it looked like Ann Rudin had something to say on that.
Well, this particular proposal does weaken the power of the city council. It specifically takes away some of the authority for selecting the charter officers. There are four charter officers. The mayor would be able to do all of that and just ask them to concur. If they don't concur, I don't know what he would do, whether he'd go on to the next group of candidates. But there's another preparation of the budget, too, is largely taken out of their hands. They don't have as much input over preparation of the budget in this proposal. So those are two examples of how I see the council becoming weaker because the mayor has taken away some of their powers and taken them unto himself.
Okay, well, we've been talking about the proposal by Mayor Kevin Johnson of Sacramento to increase the executive powers of the mayor of the city. He joined us earlier. We also heard from Fresno's outgoing Mayor Alan Autry, who is also a quote-unquote strong mayor. In our studio, Ann Rudin, a former mayor of Sacramento, and Robert Huckfeldt, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UC Davis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, TV critic Rick Cushman tells you what's new on TV and in the TV business. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Some of our most interesting shows and segments were produced by interns. You could help produce the show, too, if you make the Insight team. Learn about internships on the careers page at capradio.org. The second half of the TV season started last night. What's ahead on television? Why was the first half of the TV season so unmemorable? And how are things in the increasingly turbulent TV business? The Sacramento Bee's television critic joins us. Rick Cushman, welcome back to Insight.
Always happy to be here.
Well, tonight, I noticed that all three primetime hours on both NBC and ABC are unscripted shows. In other words, no dramas or comedies. And I know that there are at least two unscripted hours tomorrow night on NBC. Are the big networks going basic cable?
Well, you could really say that about NBC. It's still a little screwy this week because there are a couple of major college football games. Like tonight, there's the there's Texas-Ohio State. The national championship, such as it is on Thursday. And so they're still dancing around a little, or in NBC's case, literally with a dancing show. But NBC has definitely taken the low-end, or at least the low-cost approach to television. And, you know, those media companies are really feeling the economy for all kinds of reasons. And so reality is one inexpensive way to get at it.
These shows are less expensive to produce, but I'm guessing that they also don't attract as much advertising money.
Yeah, and, you know, some do, some don't. Shows like American Idol or Dancing with the Stars. But there's still a stench, if that would be the word, to some reality. And in some cases, like there's NBC's got a show called Mama's Boys. The stench is totally deserving.
That's the Ryan Seacrest production.
Yeah, and it's the one where it's another dating show. It's like The Bachelor, but those three guys and their mothers oversee their dating, which is just plain creepy as far as I'm concerned. Part of it is they don't get the same kind of advertising. And some, you know, if you hit with a reality show like an American Idol or Dancing with the Stars, and those both have this real sort of wholesome, happy feel to them, or Survivor or Amazing Race or two other examples, you know, the advertising completely there. And in fact, the numbers are so high, it's just as good or not better. But there's so many bad shows out there, bad reality shows that really don't. And they're half the time they really are just filling time.
Why are they doing this? Is this still a hangover from the writer's strike?
That's part of it. It's a long and complicated story, but in simplest of terms, you know, the entertainment world is really fractured because of the digital world. You know, you can watch so many other things. You can rent DVDs. You can watch things online. And so the advertising isn't there to begin with. The economy's bad, so that the advertising isn't there for that as well. The media companies themselves have been hurt by the economy beyond their business, and so they need to cut costs. And then there's the sort of the layover of the writer's strike and possibly the coming SAG strike, though we're hoping that doesn't happen.
The actor's strike.
Actors, yeah. It doesn't look like it, but you still don't know. And so part of it is that, you know, when the strike hit, these guys lost a lot of money, and they also lost a lot of development time. NBC took the route that NBC has taken for years, which is sort of almost game the industry in a way. They were sort of playing with things, and they didn't really go through a full development season, and so they don't really have shows to throw on, whereas CBS is the sort of the most traditional of the gangs, and they've been doing okay by developing the kinds of shows. So it's a lot of things all at once.
Rick Cushman is TV critic for the Sacramento Bee. He also writes the column The Good Life. Well, starting in the fall, one-third of NBC's weekday primetime is going to be unscripted because Jay Leno is moving from late night to primetime.
Right.
So that suggests that what NBC is doing now isn't just some temporary reaction to current circumstances. It's the game plan.
Yeah, it is. Well, and they're in fourth place. And that was a really complicated move for them for all kinds of reasons. They didn't, you know, television networks actually make most of their money, oddly enough, on their morning shows and their late night shows. The reason is because they don't cost much to produce and they're on for a lot of hours. And so they actually end up becoming really large profit centers. And they didn't want Jay Leno to go somewhere else to compete against them. But they felt a couple of years ago, they had thought that if Conan O'Brien, who's their late night guy, that if he went somewhere else, that would hurt them too. So they had this deal where they were going to get, you know, they were going to transition. But Jay Leno, who's doing very well, didn't want to leave. The guy likes to work. So this was their solution. But the downside is they're not going to have many scripted shows, and they're not going to find hit. You don't find hits with that. You fill in programming. So you're right. It is their long-term game plan. And ultimately, I can't imagine it working out well.
I can't imagine this news about Jay Leno was welcomed by either his longtime rival David Letterman or the guy who's going to replace him in late night on NBC, Conan O'Brien, because Jay Leno is going to be looking for the same guests, the same jokes, but he's going to be doing it in prime time as opposed to 11:30.
Well, right. And, you know, it really hurts Conan O'Brien in a whole bunch of ways, although he's been really gracious about it. He will not be the king. He won't be the late night guy because Leno's show is on earlier with a naturally larger audience just because of the time slot. Leno will get the better bookings. You're right. Just like he is now, he will be the second show. Letterman, I'm not so sure. You know, Letterman, for complicated reasons, you know, he may be okay with this, actually, because, you know, Leno will take away, I mean, Leno might take away Conan O'Brien viewers. NBC's people will, an hour earlier, to catch a couple of jokes, you know, their news headlines, the way late night shows can be news headlines to some people, and don't get me started down that road because I'll start crying. But, you know, so Letterman's folks might be thinking that that actually is okay for them. And on the other hand, the president of CBS, Les Moonves, is thrilled because, you know, they make a lot of money at 10 o'clock with shows like CSI Miami, which normally air 10 o'clock outside of Sacramento. And they won't have to compete with anything of any real substance from NBC.
Is there any reason to think the second half of the TV season will be more memorable than the first half?
Well, that is the good news. And yes, and that is, it is a direct result of the writer's strike, is that all the stuff that was sitting around or was didn't get developed in time for the fall is coming out now. Plus, as it turns out, just, you know, for odd reasons, a lot of good shows get launched in January anyway, like Lost and 24. And that's because they can run straight through without an interruption. So there's a lot coming back, and a couple of interesting shows on the way that look like they could be decent.
So is January the new September, October?
January is the new, winter's the new fall, I guess, is what it is. And it's sort of been that way, you know, and one of the reasons why networks had been launching shows in January was because there was less clutter, because all the really big shows were launched in September. But now there's way more shows over the next couple of weeks coming back or new shows coming out than in September this year.
Do you think the two shows on NBC that really are actual scripted shows, 30 Rock and The Office, do you think they have a long-term future? Because everyone talks about them. They got all the hype, but they don't have a whole lot of viewers.
Oh, and they're great. And 30 Rock has completely hit its stride this year, and The Office has been terrific. And that's a really good question. And I think that, you know, it can go two ways. I mean, I think that NBC is hurting itself because ratings beget ratings. When shows do well, then you have a hit to promote your other shows. And that's why networks end up being number one for a long time. It's not just that the shows are popular, but they can, you know, tease people to their other shows. And so if NBC is going to have generally lower ratings, even if they're making money, it's not going to help those guys. The flip side is that the very thing that's killing networks in general, which is this broader digital world, also spreads the word on cool and smart shows like 30 Rock and The Office. And so they may actually be getting more exposure on, you know, YouTube bits here and selling DVDs there. And so they may not need the kind of ratings that they might need to stay alive. So they may be fine with slightly lower ratings. They still could be economically sound.
What's your favorite show on TV? And I'm asking you as Rick, the guy, as opposed to Rick Cushman, the TV critic. So forget about whether it's a cool show or not. What do you most enjoy watching on TV?
Well, I'm telling you, one of the shows I love is Top Chef. Because I'm like everybody else. I'm a guy who loves to cook, even though I'm terrible at it. And I love watching these guys. And that's a Bravo show. But really, of the shows that the really good shows, the shows that are like, I can't tell you how excited I am to see Lost again. And I've watched the first 4 hours of 24, and I think that's they've got the magic back, at least in the first few 4 hours. And both of those shows were just wildly entertaining, and in Lost case, it's a great puzzle. And so I really, really enjoy those.
And does cable, subscription cable, still have its mojo?
Yeah, it does. And HBO has been hot and cold, but they've got a couple things. They've got a show called Flight of the Conchords, which if you like The Office and 30 Rock kind of wacky, slightly disjointed humor, it's really hilarious. It's the fourth most popular folk band, as they call themselves, from New Zealand, and their adventures at trying to like sell a record in New York and that sort of thing, and it's very funny. HBO, Showtime just finished Dexter, and Dexter's great. And Dexter's really has to be on paid cable because it's bloody and slightly profane. HBO has something coming in March. The ladies' number one detective agency, which is based on the series of books, and it is sweet and it is smart and it is it's lyrical and it's. I watched the 2-hour pilot. It was two of the best hours of television I watched. Well, I would say all year, but it's only been a couple of days. So they can still do that sort of thing. And in a way, that's a show that might not have gotten developed for the networks because it doesn't seem edgy enough. Oddly enough, it wasn't edgy enough for the network, so it goes to a place like HBO.
Rick Cushman is TV critic for the Sacramento Bee. Finally, Rick, as also the author of the Good Life column, which you started doing a few months ago in the Sacramento Bee, what's the favorite thing you've encountered in terms of the Good Life in Sacramento since you started writing the column?
Well, you know, I've been getting a lot of wine. That doesn't hurt at all. You know, I'd say it's this. You know, I had this conversation with a couple of different people. You know, I love Sacramento. I'm a San Francisco boy. And this was the column this was the tone of the column as a guy who loves San Francisco, too. And when I came to Sacramento, I did like this place, but I've really fallen in love with it, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, because this has evolved into a big city. I mean, I know that's part of the discussion just before us, although my view of it is it's the food and wine and out, you know, going out kind of energy that this city. And the more I look around, because now I have to, the more I discover of all the things that are out there. And I just love being out in this town.
And if you could have executive power over Sacramento's nightlife and good life and dining, what changes would you like to see?
I would totally revamp the downtown traffic and parking. You know, I covered City Hall, and when I was covering City Hall, this was back actually during Ann Rudin's era, which dates me a little bit. But, you know, I thought that the downtown traffic and parking plans were disjointed compared with the notion of trying to get people downtown. Now I think that they're really out there just to torture you. The idea is to make sure that you are as miserable as possible if you come downtown. Now, I realize there's other things.
You have to make these strange turns for no good reason.
Absolutely. And, you know, they're fun. There's some city lots that are coming up, and that's a good thing. But it just, you know, it's this growing up in San Francisco where there was always a lot of traffic, even in semi-residential neighborhoods. You know, maybe I'm a little more comfortable with it, but the idea that it's going to be a 24-hour city and yet not allow people to drive there doesn't make sense. Not until we are dense enough that you can actually have, you know, real mass transit. And so, I really would to be able to get to the places I want to go would be a really wonderful thing.
What a thing.
Yeah. I know. Who would crazy idea. I'm just throwing it out there.
Rick Cushman, TV critic for the Sacramento Bee. He also writes the column The Good Life. Rick, thank you so much for joining us again.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento man recently honored by Britain's Queen Elizabeth. He's a UK citizen who won 2 gold medals in cycling in last fall's Paralympic Games. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on the next edition of Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Britain's Queen Elizabeth honored a Sacramento man last week. In her annual New Year's list, the Queen named Mark Bristow a member of the Order of the British Empire. This was in honor of his successes at last fall's Paralympic Games in China. Bristow, a member of the British team, won 2 gold medals in cycling. He's in our studio. Mark Bristow, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
What does it mean to be a member of the Order of the British Empire?
It's just a recognition from the royal family or for the Queen themselves of what you have achieved representing the country or promoting the company, a country in many cases. For me, it's an honour that the sport that I'm involved in, cycling and the Paralympic side of it, that we achieved so much that the Queen's realised that it's been such a great thing for us that she honoured us, most of us, with the honour of the award.
Well, in the list of people who are now members of the Order of the British Empire, or OBE, as it's known in the UK, you are listed as being recognised for services to disabled sport. How do you feel about that?
That's great. It's great to be out there. I compete both on the Paralympic side and the able-bodied side, and for always proving that people with disabilities can do anything they want to. So to have the award to show that we are helping promote the equality, if you like, with people with disabilities, that we can achieve whatever we set our minds to, same as anybody else. Anything's possible.
My guest is Mark Bristow, a Sacramento man who was recently honored by Britain's Queen Elizabeth. He won 2 gold medals in cycling in last fall's Paralympic Games in China. Tell us what your disability is, because when we watch the Paralympic Games, you see all manner of disabilities.
Yes, the Paralympics covers a wide range of disability, both physical, to amputees, to people with cerebral palsy. I was involved in a cycling accident in San Francisco in 97, and I collided with a tree going a bit too fast. And I have a condition called brachial plexus, which is where C5, 6, and 7 coming out of my neck, the nerves that come down to the right side of my body, the right arm, I lost the use of C5 and C6. So I have no deltoid and shoulder muscles. I have no bicep. I have no rotation of the arm. Yet I'm fortunate enough that I do still have a wrist and can still wiggle my fingers. So I have a hand, but I have no way of controlling where the hand goes.
Were you a competitive cyclist at that time?
I was competing in a bike race at the time, and I have been a competitive cyclist since the age of 16, so it's more years than I'd like to say.
Do you remember the accident?
I remember the accident. I remember going around the last corner. It was close to the final sprint, thinking I was in a good position, and just hearing that noise everybody dreads of somebody going down. And the next thing I remember is just lying there in pain, thinking I'm okay because I can wiggle my fingers and I can wiggle my toes. And they thought I broke my neck at the time, got dragged off to hospital, tremendous amount of pain, put on painkillers, went home that day. They diagnosed a broken shoulder and a broken collarbone. It wasn't until the next day that the sling actually came unattached, that my arm dropped to the side. I hit the floor in pain, that I then realized I can't move the arm. I've broken collarbones before, most cyclists have, but to be lying on the floor thinking, hang on, I can't get my hand to move, was then a realization that it was something major. And we went back to the hospital and it was diagnosed then.
And what did they have to do? Nerve transplants?
They've tried 2 major surgeries with me. They did a nerve graft or a nerve replacement where they took the casings out of my neck and replaced them with nerves out of my leg to replace them in the upper part of the neck, hoping that the nerve would regrow from the spine back to the arm, which didn't work. And 18 months after that, they then took nerves that were in between your ribs and transplanted them, cut them all the way back up and poked them down the arm.
My goodness.
Trying to get the bicep to work from muscles that would normally use to help you deep breathe. And I always remember asking the doctor, how will I know that it worked? And he said, probably because you'll sneeze one day and you'll hit yourself in the face, because it will work. Unfortunately, it hasn't. And I am left with a sensation that if you touch my upper arm, it feels like you're touching my chest, because the nerves haven't yet learnt that they're not where they are now. They still think they're attached to the chest when they're actually in my upper arm.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's a weird sensation. But for the doctors to do such amazing work, all based out of San Francisco, was great.
Is that it then? Is your arm as recovered as it's ever going to be?
The arm's as recovered as it's ever going to be. You do have a lot of underlying muscles that sort of stabilize the muscles, that when you don't have the major muscle groups to work, they obviously become bigger and stronger. And I can now move the arm more now than I could 10 years ago, because those muscles slowly get stronger to replace it. But as you can see in the studio, if I let go, take the arm off the chair, it will hang by my side. I have limited movement of it.
Did you go through a period of thinking, you know, I really got a terrible injury here from riding a bike, I better stop that?
No, not really. It's actually quite strange. I think my wife and my family will know that within about 3 months of doing the injury, I was back out on a bike again, because it was something I loved doing. And whether I was competing or not, I just like riding a bike. I think Lance Armstrong said it once, that it's like being a big kid. You get out there and go and play on your bike. And that's how I feel about cycling, and that's why I continue to do so.
Did you have to do a lot of work to relearn how to ride a bike without effective use of your right arm?
Yes. Seems strange now that I've probably raced as much one-handed as I have two-handed. But after a period of time, you just get used to balancing the bike basically one-armed. I have the hands, so I can still use the gears and the brakes with the right hand, but I have difficulty moving it around the bars. But all the balance is ridden on the left arm, and if you see my riding a bike now, you'll notice the bike leans about 5 to 10 degrees to the left as I'm balancing the saddle on the inside of the left leg as well.
Do you ride slower? Do you ride down less steep hills? Because you had this terrible crash when you had full use of both arms.
I wouldn't say I ride any slower. I wouldn't say it's tempered me in many ways with regard to my riding in a bunch. But the speeds I'm doing now are probably faster and greater than I was doing when I was able-bodied, because I've trained more specifically for the speed work, which is where it comes into involving racing on the track, which is where I picked up the 2 gold medals. So, no, I don't think it's changed my riding style that much.
My guest is Mark Bristow, Sacramento man who was recently honoured by Britain's Queen Elizabeth. He won 2 gold medals in cycling in last fall's Paralympic Games in China, in Beijing. What was that like going to China?
Going to China was great. To turn up at the Paralympic Village with the British team, to go into the same village as they used for the regular Olympics, the same venues, was awesome. The Chinese people, absolutely amazing. Every venue we went to, and I got the chance to go to the Bird's Nest as well as the Velodrome, was full to capacity. For them to be able to fill a 60,000 or 70,000 seater at the Bird's Nest, and even for the cycling events to have 6,000 people all the time in the stands, knowledgeable, cheering on local support, cheering on world records and performances, it was just great. It was just totally awesome to be there.
You did pretty well. I'm looking at your results, and in the 1 kilometer time trial that you did for people with an upper body disability like you, you won quite convincingly, and you won a world record.
Yes. The British team, we'd talked about it before the year to show how scientific our training was. We knew that a 1:08 would win it. My training was on time.
1 minute and 8 seconds?
1 minute and 8 seconds would probably win it. 1 minute 9.0 something was the previous world record, so we knew we had to be on for a 1:08 to win it. So it was pleasing to do my ride at Beijing. They seeded us based on world championship performances, and the year before I'd got fourth, so I went fourth from the end as there's only one rider at the time. So I did the new world record and then had to sit down and watch as 3 other riders got up behind me, all had beaten me the year before at the world championships, not beat my time, which was quite nerve-wracking to many respects. But I remember when Michael Gallagher got up to ride the last event, after his 3 of the 4 laps, we knew he wasn't going to do it, and that was it. It was just a release and a relief that, I'd gone there, done what I needed to do, and come away with the rewards.
And your other gold, for listeners who are curious, was the men's team sprint. The next Games, Olympic Games and Paralympic Games, are in London, which is not too far from where you were born, in Essex.
Yes.
Are you hoping to participate there?
Would love to. Success is great. The only disadvantage from the success that it brings more people into the sport. So with the success that British cycling's had, both in the Olympics and Paralympics, 4 years is a long time in any sport, and you can imagine all the newcomers that are out there that have seen all the publicity, seen all the success that the sport's had, wanting to get involved. I can see standards just getting higher and higher and higher, and I'm getting older and older and older, so I need to keep what I'm doing, and if not getting faster, to realistically be there. But it's something I will get up and train for every day like I've done and see how we go.
And finally, Mark, this will have to be quick, but I must ask, now that you're a member of the Order of the British Empire, as declared by Queen Elizabeth, does she tap you on the shoulder with a sword or anything?
No, that's the knighthood that's been honoured for Chris Hoy this year. I get to go and meet her over the next few months and shake her hand and be awarded the medal, and hopefully I'll be able to take my wife and kids there as well. So it should be a good day.
Well, congratulations, Mark, on what you've achieved, and thanks so much for coming into our studio.
No, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been great. Thank you.
That's Mark Bristow, Sacramento man, recently honoured by Britain's Queen Elizabeth. He won 2 gold medals in cycling in last fall's Paralympic Games in China. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. A local law professor has been named to President-elect Barack Obama's Justice and Civil Rights Agency review team. On the next Insight, Cruz Reynoso tells you about the team and what they plan to accomplish before Obama's inauguration. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.